welcome all. My name's Arnie Hackett. We have Chris Meyer today, who is the comm server security designer. He's going to take us through the ZOS communication server network security overview. With that, I'll turn the session over to Chris.
Thanks, Arnie. Like I already said, my name is Chris Meyer. I work in the ZOS Communication Server Design Group with a focus on security. The presentation we're going to be looking at today is one that was presented at SHARE back in March. Lynn Overby was there presenting this. He and I have done this presentation before, so that's why you see his name in the title bar on here. So trademarks and notices, I'm sure you've all seen those kinds of things before. So what we're going to be talking about today is security features of a ZOS communication server. Mainly we're going to be talking about the policy-based network security features. Before we get into the actual topic areas, we'll talk a little bit about the roles and objectives of security support within comm server and some of the deployment trends we've seen and requirements that we're discussing. Topic areas, we'll talk about policy-based network security, specifically three areas, IP security, which includes both packet filtering and IPsec, something called application transport layer security, or ATTLS, and some built-in intrusion detection services we have in comm server. From there, we'll move on and talk a little bit about how to configure these things through our configuration assistant, and then at the end, we'll talk a little bit more about enterprise security roles and how comm server can actually extend some of its capabilities farther out into the enterprise. So the security and roles, this chart kind of tries to lay out the areas of responsibility as we see them with regard to security. Comm server is very much like a front door into ZOS. So any of the network traffic you have going into and out of ZOS is going to be coming through comm server. So we have some responsibility to make sure that the access to the system is, and the data that's flowing is being protected properly. There's two perspectives on our role in security. One, on the left-hand side, is to protect the data on ZOS and the other resources on ZOS from the network. So things like protecting availability, looking for things like denial of service attacks, unwanted access, identification, authentication, making sure that the users that are coming into the system are the ones we expect to see, and access controls to make sure that those users that we do allow in are getting to the resources that they're supposed to be getting to. The other side of the coin is protecting the data that's either originating on ZOS or destined to ZOS is protected while it's traveling in the network. So three aspects of that is data, the origin authentication, so making sure that when we receive data that it's actually from the person who it claims to be from, or when we send it out that we can prove that it came from us. Message integrity, to make sure that messages coming in over the network haven't been changed somewhere along the line. And privacy, which means encrypting the data so that somebody who's snooping can't really see what's being passed across the network. So you see in the picture here a few different functional areas that contribute to all of this. The security protocols like IPsec, SSL, Secure Socket Layer, along with TLS, and the SNA session level encryption, all those are protocols that are kind of oriented toward protecting data as it travels in the network. You also see RACF on the right, which we use heavily for the identification and authentication functions, as well as for the access control. And then down the right-hand side, you see ZOS Comm Server IDS, the Intrusion Detection Support. Again, capability that's built right into Comm Server to protect the stack and the applications behind it from attacks and detecting when someone might be planning an attack. So that's kind of the big picture. Before we start talking about the actual functional areas, talk a little bit about some of the trends we've been seeing. Traditionally, network security field was kind of thought of as a perimeter kind of a job. So put a couple firewalls out on the perimeter of the network, and then you're protecting your network. As time's gone on, people have come to realize that isn't really the sufficient way to protect your network. A couple of reasons for that. A long time ago, when network access for ZOS was based on SNA only, you had a pretty closed system and good controls over who could get into that network. Now with TCP/IP and the internet access from everywhere, there's much more access to the ZOS systems, either directly through the internet or indirectly through other systems. So there's a much more increased focus now on self-protecting the ZOS system. The other thing is that perimeter-only defenses don't protect you at all from attacks that occur from within your enterprise. And it's a pretty well-known fact that most of the attacks that are being seen are coming from within anymore. So this defense in depth is an approach where, yes, you certainly need to secure your perimeters, but all the way back to each server, you need to have some capability to protect yourself from unauthorized access and that kind of thing. So that's kind of the focus of some of the security features in ComServer. Looking at ZOS as a security endpoint for IPsec and for TLS, we're seeing a lot of increased encryption deployment on ZOS between ZOS systems and even to other platforms. We've observed that with both TLS and ATTLS deployments as well as with IPsec. And from the things we've been learning, it looks like that growth is only going to continue. So this kind of pushes the security functions that have been traditionally deployed into the network, again, back to the server. And as you add more encryption to the end-to-end kind of an environment, in some of the cases, you're actually taking away capabilities from the network-based security services from being able to do the things they used to do, because a firewall might not be able to, or an IDS in the network might not be able to inspect something that's been encrypted. And finally, a lot of these trends we're seeing are being driven by standards like the payment card industry data security standard or HIPAA and things like that. People are going through audits and finding out they need to beef up their defenses. So we've seen a number of cases where not only are these things being driven kind of from the top down, but they're also being driven on unexpected timetables. They need to be deployed quickly. So another goal we have is to minimize the deployment costs and the deployment time of putting these defenses into your system. So that goes from everything from reducing the application cost by doing things in an application transparent way so you don't have to modify each application, doing things in a policy-based way so you can reduce the number of people who have to be involved in actually defining the security policies, and providing some good tooling so it's easy to conceptually build these policies. This next chart is sort of a big picture of the different security capabilities within ComServer, sort of broken up into the protect the system from the network left side versus protect data as it traverses the network on the right side. So if we start in the lower left about protecting the system at the lowest layers of the IP stack, the first thing that gets involved is IP packet filtering. So this is something that's way down in the networking layer, and it essentially makes sure that each IP packet that's either coming in or trying to go out of the system is supposed to be doing that. Traffic that is not authorized, the packets get dropped. Otherwise, they get permitted, or else IPsec security can also be applied. Moving up a layer, both in the networking layer and in the transport layer, we have intrusion detection services. So these are different probes along the way that look for a number of different things, like malformed packets, can detect floods, and even does some things in terms of limiting the number of connections a given user can get. So we'll talk more about that in a little while. Moving up higher in the transport layer, we have the Servos class in the system access facility, or system authorization facility, which is used to enforce a number of different access controls at the network layer, the stack layer, and the port layer. We're not really going to talk a lot about those in this presentation, but felt it was important to bring those up and let you know that those were there. And then moving all the way up, in terms of protecting the system into the application layer, a number of the applications that we ship, and certainly applications that you write and other ones you buy, can take advantage of staff, again, access controls, making sure that the right users are getting access to the right data. So I'll go down the right side now, kind of from the top down. To protect the data in the network, again, some of our applications and the protocols themselves have built-in security extensions like SNMP and OSPF. So those are present in some of those applications. Moving down the layer, in the API layer where the sockets exists, we provide two different capabilities. One is Kerberos, and the other is Secure Sockets Layer or Transport Layer Security. So this essentially is a set of libraries and APIs that you can use to add security to your applications if you want to go about doing that way. Both of these are focused on TCP, connection-oriented applications, though they don't really deal with UDP too much. Moving down the transport layer, so we talked a little bit about SSL and TLS here. Something we did a few releases ago was come up with this application transparent TLS. So what that does is it removes in a lot of cases, completely remove the burden from the application to enable themselves for TLS. Instead, the TCP layer actually does the TLS operations based on policy that's read in through the policy agent. Again, we'll talk more about that in a couple of minutes. And then down the networking layer, again, the data is going out. Packet filtering, again, can decide whether or not it's really supposed to be going in or out. And for outbound traffic, the packet filters also decide when IPsec security needs to be applied to the packet. So that's kind of the big picture and how all these different things fit together going up and down the stack. So now we can start talking a little bit more about the specific security features of ComServer. Again, we'll be talking about policy-based security, again, IP security, ATTLS, and intrusion detection services. Before we get into those actual functional areas, take a quick look at how policy-based security works in general. At the core of our policy-based security is something called Policy Agent. This is a Unix application that runs on ZOS that pulls in policies that have been written either by hand or preferably through our configuration assistant user interface. It reads them off disk, parses them out, and then installs these policies into the appropriate places in the stack. So we have policies for ATTLS, we have policies for IP security, we have them for IDS, and there's also some others that aren't quite as much security related. Once those policies are installed in the stack, then the stack actually enforces the policies as they go along. So that's kind of the picture that the rest of this presentation is based on. Okay, so let's talk about the IP security features in ComServer. Again, this includes filtering and IPsec. So IP security is a complete IP filtering solution as well as implementation of IP security, IPsec standard, and the Internet Key Exchange standard that's closely related to IPsec. This capability is integrated into ComServer and has been for several releases now. It replaces a product called Firewall Technologies. It used to be available, and the last release that was available was V1R7. So since V1R8, the only IPsec and IP filtering support is built right into ComServer. Again, IP filtering is there. There's a couple different flavors of IPsec. Manual IPsec, where you actually code everything and enable it all by hand. And then there's also dynamic IPsec, where IKE daemon, Internet Key Exchange daemon, does all the key exchange and negotiations for you based on rules. And again, all of these capabilities do various amounts of logging, which is controllable to some degree. Some of the features, won't go through all of these in great detail. The supported configurations, we'll talk a little bit more about this in another chart, but the IPsec implementation in ZOS is optimized for ZOS acting as in a host-to-host or a host-to-gateway kind of a configuration. And again, I'll explain what that means a little bit more in a minute. But what this is saying is that we consider, in the vast majority of the cases, the ZOS will be treated as a host versus being a router. Now, there is some gateway capability in there. It's been in there all along. We've continued to support that, but again, we've optimized for ZOS as a host. We also support NAT traversal, both for IP addresses as well as port translation. We support IPv4 and IPv6 in the implementation. What else? There's quite a bit of stuff in here. Pretty well up to date on cryptographic algorithms with the HMAX. We use 128-bit AES is the strongest encryption we do with triple DES and DES and a variety of other things. Some of the newer features we've built in over the last few releases is one that's gotten quite a bit of discussion is ZIP-assisted IPsec. This is the idea that with IPsec being a very cryptographically intensive and therefore CPU-intensive operations, we've taken the ability to move some of that processing off of the general purpose processors onto ZIPs, which has been received very well. We certainly take advantage of hardware cryptographic capability that exists and all that, but this still moves a fairly significant amount of the processing off of the general purpose processor. We also added some security monitoring interfaces over the last few releases. This gives you the capability to monitor as well as control IPsec and IP filtering operations through an API. And the Tivoli Omegamon XC for mainframe networks product has actually exploited that interface. And if you've ever seen it, there's a lot of nice user interface-driven capability to manage your IPsec operations on DOS. And we've also added some SMF records as well. with a lot of the similar information as to what's available through the API. So we're continuing to build on this capability as time goes on. Okay, so IP packet filtering basics. Essentially, the way our packet filtering works is, again, it's based on policy that's written and brought in through the policy agent. And each filter rule is written to identify IP packets based on the attributes of that packet. So things like the destination address and source address, destination port and source port, what protocol it is, and things like that. Even things like the direction the packet is traveling. The rules are built to describe the traffic. Then as the traffic is coming into the system or about to go out of the system, the attributes of the packet are matched up against the rules as they're written. And when we find a match, we look at the matching rules to find out what actions should be taken. And there's a couple different actions you can take. You can either permit the packet to flow if the rule says to do that and let it pass along to wherever the next destination is. If it's a deny rule, then we just drop the packet, maybe log it. Or the other possible action is to permit it with IPsec protection. And again, that can either be manual or dynamic IPsec. So you can kind of think of IP filtering as sort of the gateway into IPsec as well. And again, with any of these rules, we have logging that's available so you can go back and audit what's going on in terms of your traffic. Last thing is, these rules apply both to routed traffic as well as for local traffic. So, you know, we can make sure that if we're being used as a router, that we're only routing traffic that's being allowed to be treated that way. A little bit more on how we match filters. The key on this chart is that the order that you configure your filters is very important. The order that you build them in your policy is very important, because that's the order that they'll be installed and that they'll be searched in. So what we recommend is that the most specific rules are at the top of the list. So a rule that identifies a particular port, a particular time of day, a particular direction should exist in the list before one that's more generalized for maybe just a single IP address or something like that. Again, as soon as we find a rule that matches a packet, that's the rule that will get applied. This chart, again, kind of lists some of the things that can include in the filter specification. So, like I said, addresses, ports, things like that, codes for ICMP and OSPF, things like that. Something we added in V1R10 was the ability to build filters based on fragmentation as well. So, not going to go through all that. You can look at that for reference later on. But it gives you a flavor of the kinds of things we'll build rules. So that kind of finishes up the IP filtering, so let's move on to IPsec. And again, a quick overview of how IPsec fits into the US Comm Server. IPsec is a network layer security protocol. It's defined by the IETF. There's all kinds of different RFCs for it, so it's a well-understood standard. It provides a number of different protections for data in the network. Authentication, integrity checking, as well as encryption and data privacy. So all those things can be built into your IPsec rules as you see fit. Again, this is built in the IP layer, so it doesn't require any kind of application change. It's completely transparent to your application. And an interesting thing about IPsec versus something like an SSL is that the secure sessions that are built, they're called security associations. Those security associations are actually built in between IP resources, not necessarily applications. So whereas you would establish an SSL connection from an FTP client to an FTP server, an IPsec security association can be very general if you want it to be, so that all the traffic between one IP address and another IP address is protected under that security association. You can also define SAs to be very specific, like you can with TLS, but it just gives you more flexibility in the way you can protect data. And again, key management can be done manually by actually coding some of these things into the configuration, or it can be done in an automated fashion using the iSeedman. If you're going to do any kind of a sizable deployment of IPsec, we would certainly recommend that you use Ike and Dynamic Key Exchange. So a couple of different charts just to kind of show how the IPsec implementation in ZOS is able to operate. With IPsec, there's the notion of a data endpoint and a security endpoint. The data endpoint is where the data that you want to protect actually lives, or is going to end up anyway. So it's the endpoint that's going to own the socket the data is coming off of. Security endpoint is some node along the way in the network that applies IPsec protection. So in some cases, the data security, the data endpoint and security endpoint can be the same node. And that's traditionally how you would think of things. So it's the hosts are what own the data, are the data endpoints. And we think of security endpoints typically in terms of gateways. ZOS, the ZOS IPsec implementation can support both host and gateway functionality. So this chart kind of describes the environments that our IPsec support can operate in a host function. So the first one is a host-to-host configuration where, you know, this might be like the FTP kind of example, FTP client talks to an FTP server. So the data and security endpoint are on the one node, and it establishes a session all the way to the other node. Data is protected end-to-end. The one below is called host-to-gateway environment where you're protecting data all the way to the server on the left, the ZOS system, but it might only be protected out to some gateway, maybe some router out in the network. And then once it hits that gateway, the IPsec protocol terminates, and everything behind that gateway could flow in the clear. So this might be like a branch office kind of environment or something. Again, ZOS will function in both of these configurations as a host. Going on to the next slide, this shows how ZOS can operate as a gateway. So there's two scenarios here, one gateway talking to another, so we support that just fine, as well as a gateway talking to some specific host at the remote end. So again, these are all different configurations that IPsec is set up to support, and just showing you that we have a complete implementation for all these things. All right. So that is about as much detail as we'll go into for IPsec right now. Again, if you want to learn more about that, we can always talk more about that on an individual basis. So let's move on to application transparent TLS. So before we get into the application transparent part, I'll just talk a little bit about TLS. Transport Layer Security is actually the IETF standard of Secure Sockets Layer that Netscape invented. So the TLS itself actually has a compatibility mode for SSL version 3. It's very, very similar. So TLS or SSL, we'll use those terms interchangeably usually. It requires a secure or a reliable connection-oriented transport. So again, this is a TCP security feature, not UDP or raw sockets, that kind of thing. And again, this protects data at the application layer. So the endpoints will be one application on one end and then, you know, the comparable application on the other end. It's not a tunnel kind of a thing like IPsec. So traditionally, you know, when they came up with SSL, you know, if you wanted to take advantage of SSL, you would go into your sockets application and change the API calls so they would, you know, use the SSL function. Provide a great security, but it requires you to go in and actually change your code. Now, ZOS provides a complete SSL library. It's called System SSL. It's part of the cryptographic services element. But what we did in V1R7 was came up with this notion of application transparent TLS inside of the communication server that would allow you to take advantage of the benefits of TLS without actually having to change your code. So the way that works is, again, this is a policy-driven capability. So we have a separate agent TLS policy that the policy agent can read and install into the stack, in this case at the transport layer. And the way that policy is written, again, it will describe certain types of traffic, you know, whether it's between certain IP addresses, between different ports, and that kind of thing. When we see a connection being established that matches that policy, we'll go ahead and read the policy, and it will tell us what kind of TLS protection to apply to it. So in this case, the TCP component of the TCP/IP stack actually becomes the user of the system SSL services. So it relieves the application from having to make those calls. Now, a lot of applications won't care that this is happening at all. Those are the truly application transparent cases. We call these basic ATTLS applications. So, you know, you apply the SSL protection underneath the covers and it's perfectly happy. There are some applications, though, that will want to know when certain things related to SSL are happening. So maybe they want to know when a handshake is occurring. They might want to examine the X509 certificate that the client passed up if you're using client authentication, things like that. So think of it as sort of a read-only kind of access into some of the things that ATTLS is doing. We call those ATTLS aware applications. And you can hook into some of those things using this TTLS control IOXL call. Going a step further than that, some applications might actually need to insert themselves to control when TLS operations are occurring. So a good example is FTP. If you issue the auth command on there, it's essentially saying, okay, I want to start using TLS. For applications like that, we call them controlling applications. And again, through that same IOXL call, there is the ability to say, okay, I want to start TLS, or I want to reset a cipher and various controls like that. So, depending on the application's needs, the ability is there to get involved in the operation. So, what are the advantages of using ATTLS versus just decoding the system SSL library? Well, the most obvious one is that you don't have to change your source code. You're able to leverage the capabilities without, you know, changing the line of code. And that not only means you don't have to write to the system SSL APIs, but it also means that you don't have to define new configuration controls on your application to specify what cipher suite to use, or you know, whether or not you want to require client authentication. So there's more code involved than just the API calls themselves. Another thing is that ATTLS actually exploits some of the system SSL above and beyond what most people would typically do when they first do a system SSL integration. Things like exploiting certificates, being able to support multiple key rings per server, and things like that. ATTLS is a fairly advanced system SSL, so you get a lot more capability for less code, essentially. The other thing is, with ATTLS, we're trying to keep up with the new things that are being added into system SSL. So as they come up with new algorithms that they support, maybe 256 bits, whatever it might be, ATTLS will keep up with those things. So it allows your application to take advantage of those new features, again, without having to change. At least change the code. All you got to do is maybe update your policy a bit. Another nice thing is that ATTLS can actually be used to protect traffic that's not just C-based sockets. In other words, kick sockets, assembler, pretty much any kind of the sockets interface except for the Pascal interface can be protected with ATTLS. And again, administrative costs can be significantly reduced because you can essentially reduce the number of people that need to be involved in defining and configuring the SSL protections to a small group of people that are dealing with policy versus people that are deploying applications. Next chart, and this is similar to the one you saw for IP Sec support. Again, this just kind of shows you the kinds of attributes that you can include on your ATTLS policy. One I didn't mention before, it exists on most policy agent policies, is time condition. You can actually set up your policy so that rules are in effect only certain times of the day. So, you know, if you have a bank and you'll want your certain employees to be able to access account information from home from certain times of the day, or maybe you don't want them to get it from home during the day, you can build rules to accommodate that kind of stuff. Okay, talk a little bit about the roles that ATTLS can perform. With SSL or TLS, there's essentially two roles. There's the server and there's the client. The client initiates the session to the server, and the whole handshake goes on. ATTLS can serve both of those roles. These charts kind of, I think they're focused more on where you need to have certificates and things like that. But the key to take out of this is that you can operate both as a TLS server and a TLS client using ATTLS. You see in the bottom here that if you want to do client authentication, which is something that's optional in SSL, if you want to do that, there is a capability of supporting client authentication. So we're pretty well up to date on the capabilities that SSL and TLS provide you. Same deal as acting as a client. We support both of those environments. All right. So after we talked about some of those advantages and everything, ComServer itself, you know, ships a number of applications, and two of those in particular had already been enabled or integrated directly with system SSL. So our TN3270 server as well as our FTP server had done direct integration to system SSL over time. Once we finished up ATTLS and we're talking about these advantages, you know, we decided we wanted to buy into those ourselves. So in V1R9, we went ahead and updated both of those applications so they could, you know, we retained the old integrations if you want to continue using those, but we also provided the option of using ATTLS for the data protection. The general approach that we took for doing that was, if you look in the configuration for each of those applications, there tends to be some configuration parameters that relate specifically to SSL or TLS. What we did is we added a new parameter in each of those to say either use, you know, the legacy SSL integration or use ATTLS instead. So on this chart you can see how we did that for TN3270. Before you had a number of options, just the secure port parameter actually said to use SSL. Starting at V1R9 that means use the existing SSL integration. And we added a new parameter called TTLS port, which says use ATTLS instead. Some of the other parameters, like the con type, will be honored regardless of which of the SSL integrations you choose, because they talk more about the nature of the way it's going to be used rather than the specific implementation. So now you'd also see that there are a number of parameters like the CRL, the LDAP server, different cipher suite kinds of parameters and things like that. If you choose the TTLS port option to say that you want to use ATTLS instead, those things are just ignored if they're found in the configuration. So it all kind of hooks off to that one switch. Again, the next chart talks about similar kind of thing, what it looks like in FTP. Again, we added a new keyword TLS mechanism that says which one to use, and we followed a similar approach there. So now we've talked about, we've got IPsec, we've got ATTLS. Well, which one do I use when? Well, it's kind of a tough question to answer, and you know, as you might guess, the answer is going to be it depends, right? It depends on the type of traffic you want to protect. It depends on the network topology that you might be trying to accommodate. There's a whole host of things that you might want to consider. So this table here presents some of those considerations you might want to look at, and how both the different protocols kind of relate to the considerations. So, for example, you know, IPsec will handle any protocol. TLS is focused on TCP. You know, scope of protection with an IPsec security association is kind of all-encompassing depending on how you write the rule. It can be done at the IP address level. It can be done at a protocol level. It can be done on the port level, single connection. But TLS, again, is protecting a single connection at a time. So there's a number of considerations here to look at. I'm not claiming this is an exhaustive list, but it's at least a good place to start looking at. All right, so let's kind of switch gears now and talk about intrusion detection services. So what is an intrusion? There's actually a number of different behaviors to look for here. I think the typical thing somebody thinks of as an intrusion is somebody either gaining unauthorized access or launching a denial of service attack or something like that. And those are certainly are intrusions. But it can also be something more subtle, like someone scanning your network just to gather information about it to decide what they should try to attack. So they might be looking at the network topology, might be trying to figure out what systems are on your network and what ports are open on each one, things like that. Another type of aspect of an intrusion is someone who's trying to either impersonate another user, so trying to be like a man in the middle, or install software on a system that might be inside your enterprise so it can be used as a robot later on to actually launch an attack from within your enterprise. And again, denial of service, we've talked, you know, that's kind of the typical thing. Somebody comes in and is trying to block out services so legitimate users can't get at it. That could be a single packet attack in certain cases, or it might just be somebody trying to flood an IP address or a port with a lot of traffic so nobody else can get to it. So IDS kind of attacks or looks at all those things. We'll see more about that in a minute. A couple of important things to note, though, is attacks can be, and you think of them as deliberate actions, but they can also be unintentional. I mean, we've seen a number of cases where our IDS stuff kicked in, and it was because of a poorly behaved application or configuration. Network configuration wasn't quite right. So it's not always a deliberate act. And again, a point I made earlier was that while the first thing you typically think of as an attack is somebody, you know, outside your network trying to get in, it's not always the case. You know, a lot of attacks are launched from within, either from somebody who's actually trying to, you know, maliciously cause problems or access data they shouldn't be accessing, or else by, again, like a bot that's been taken over from the outside. So there's a lot of different ways these attacks can be launched, and again, the key here is that a perimeter-only strategy isn't going to protect you against all of those things. So there's two approaches to do an intrusion detection. I think the more traditional view on this is that it's some kind of a sensor that's deployed inside the network to look for suspicious traffic and do something with it. So that's an external IDS sensor. The other approach is actually have IDS capability right on the host. So this kind of looks at both of those and compares them. So for an external sensor, those are typically built on what's called a signature-based scheme. So it'll know for certain patterns to look for in the messages that are coming across the network. And this could be anything from the network layer all the way up into application layers, things like cross-site scripting and all kinds of different web-based attacks. The signatures are written to look inside the HTTP payloads and things like that. So these kinds of sensors are good for looking for that sort of traffic. If it finds something they consider suspicious, it can dump it. Otherwise, it'll go ahead and let it proceed on through the network. Now, if a packet hits a server itself, there's also IDS capability can be done there as well. One of the things I mentioned earlier is that when you apply network encryption, it can actually blind some of the network security devices in your network, and an IDS is a good example of that. If an IDS is depending on scanning a packet looking for certain patterns, if that packet's encrypted, it can't look for the pattern it's looking for. Everything's scrambled. So one of the nice things about a host-based IDS is that the intrusion detection can be applied after data has been decrypted. So again, the idea here is that inside the host, you can insert IDS probes, the networking layer, the middleware layer, all the way up to the application layer if you want to look for certain things. In this case, though, the checking is done kind of within the context of the session itself. So another advantage the server has is that it understands the context of the data that's coming in a little bit better than a network-based device can in some cases, because it'll know what sessions are being managed, who's using them, things like that, and states of sessions even, whether or not a given packet should be received given the state of the connection. So again, all of those are considerations for where a server-based IDS might have an advantage. Regardless of how the IDS is deployed, typically what's going to happen is the IDS is going to either allow the packet to proceed through the network or into the host. But if it sees something suspicious, it'll raise some kind of an event. And typically the way it does that is it'll write something to a log or it'll send a message to some kind of a centralized management console or device, like a Tivoli security operations manual or manager or something like that, so that all these different events can be collected in one place and analyzed as a whole. So one of the key notes to get out of this is that, you know, there's two different approaches to this, but it's not an either or kind of a choice. You really want to look at using a server-based IDS along with the sensor-based IDS because they complement each other very well. We'll go over this one pretty quick. This kind of shows how the ZOS comm server IDS support works. Again, you know, you see policy agent up there in the upper left. So it reads the IDS policy in this case, installs it into the transport and network layers. What it's installing is essentially probes, where we're looking for different kinds of events or behaviors. So when we see a packet come in, again, we'll if it hits one of these probes, we'll go ahead and raise an event. The way we do that is by writing the syslog. In some cases, we'll go ahead and block packets if they're doing things that we just know is outright wrong, like a malformed packet or things like that. In a lot of other cases, we'll just write logs saying, hey, this looks like suspicious activity. You might want to do something about it. So it all depends on the kind of an event that's being looked at. But the kinds of things we look for are we'll do scan detection, so we have a capability of trying to notice when somebody is trying to map our system, either quickly or slowly. We have sensitivity levels that you can adjust to look for those things, and it can be TCP or UDP port scans, ICMP scans, that kind of thing. There's certain kinds of attacks that we'll look for. A lot of them are related to the way IP packets or TCP messages are built, the options they're using, protocols they're using, that kind of thing. But the other thing we'll look for is flood within the attack realm. So if we see that we're starting to get more packets than usual, either from a specific address or even across addresses, we'll start reporting on those kinds of things so action can be taken. And then finally, another key piece of this is something called traffic regulation. This applies in different forms to both TCP and UDP. For TCP, it allows you to control how many connections a given user can get to a given port. And it also allows you to control the total number of connections that will be allowed for a given port. So it's a way of limiting the TCP resources to your set of users, so not one user can monopolize all of them. For UDP, it's building limits on the size of the UDP receive queues. So again, trying to make sure we don't flood the system and take it out. Okay, there's a little bit, two different Civly products I can tell you about that support IDS events. Again, I mentioned that we write these messages into the NetView product is able to consume those messages and act on them. So it'll do things like send emails to certain users. It can even issue commands when it sees these things coming in. There's also a product called Civly Security Operations Manager, which is not, it's more of an enterprise-based tool, whereas NetView is focused very much on ZOS. TSOM is, supports lots of different devices, lots of different vendors, and that kind of thing. But again, it can collect COM server IDS messages and take those as part of an overall set of events to figure out if there's attacks going on. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, I think I'm starting to run out of time here, but in V1R10, we added a new feature called defensive filtering. I talked about all these abilities in IDS to say, hey, something bad might be happening here, and we've talked about a couple of different products that can take those events and actually decide if something bad really is happening. And what we haven't talked about is a way to take action if that determination is made. So defensive filters provide you a tool to use to take some action in those cases. So these are built very much, the internals, they're built very much like the configured IP filters. The difference is that you don't configure them, you actually install them through the IPsec command. So you actually describe the traffic that you want to drop or you want to block out, and then you issue, you know, when you issue that command, it installs that deny filter, and it installs it in front of all the configured IP filters. So again, the idea here is that if you have NetView or TSOM or something like that collecting these messages and it sees that there's an attack coming out from a specific address or that kind of thing, you can issue commands to block that traffic temporarily. So that's the basic idea behind the defensive filtering. So I'm about out of time. We'll take a real quick look at the configuration assistant. So this is the user interface I've been mentioning that we recommend that you use to build your policies. If you ever look at the policy agent flat files, there's a lot of parameters in them. There's a lot of detail in them, and it's easy to kind of get consumed by those details. What Configuration Assistance does is it allows you to approach the whole security realm from a conceptual kind of a perspective. So rather than worrying about what parameters you're going to specify, you can decide on the types of traffic you want to protect, the types of protection you want to apply to that traffic, what systems are involved, and finally, when you have all those pieces together, you can start identifying specific network paths from IP address to IP address that you want to apply those rules to. So it's a very flexible tool. It allows you to approach it in a much more intuitive way than just starting to write all kinds of policies. That tool has been enhanced over the last couple of releases to be able to import. If you've written your own policy files, it's now able to import those things and work with them. So when we first built it, you had to do everything through the user interface. Now it's a little bit more flexible in being able to accommodate things you've done by hand. Okay. The Configuration Assistant is actually a Windows application, so you can download it off of our website. I think the URL might be in here later on. But you do all the analysis and configuration on the Windows workstation, and then at the end, you tell it to go ahead and generate the policy files and other configuration files that are needed on a given ZOS system. And you can actually, through the configuration system, go ahead and upload those right to the ZOS system. And every release that we do, we have closer and closer integration with Z, so that this tool is much more capable each release. last topic I want to talk about is enterprise-wide security roles. So this really gets into the ability to extend ZOS security capabilities out to multiple systems. And there's two different aspects to this. One is related to certificate management, the other is related to policy. But this picture here, before V1R9, every ZOS image kind of had to have its own policy files. It had to have its own key rings for, in this case, for IPsec application. And even if there was a lot of commonality between those different systems, you had to have these things deployed to each one. And so the idea here is that rather than having everybody log on to every individual system, it'd be nice to centralize some of these capabilities. So there's two enhancements that came in V1R9 that we're building upon in later releases. First one is called centralized policy management, and the other one is called network security services. So this is the centralized policy management we're looking at now. The idea is that instead of deploying your policy to every individual ZOS system, you select one ZOS LPAR to be your policy agent server. You still build different policy for each LPAR, but what you can do is deploy them all to a single policy agent server, and then the LPARs on the left that are the clients actually go to that server to retrieve their policy. So they're centralizing the policy in a single place. So that's kind of the idea, again, distributing that out from a centralized place. Okay, so last thing on the NSF that I was talking about. So one of the things we'd like to be able to do with NSF over time is be able to extend ZOS security capabilities not only to multiple ZOS systems, but further into the enterprise and to even non-ZOS platforms. And we took the first step into doing that in V1R10. We added a new capability to NSF so that something called XML appliances, and this was really the initial exploiter of this, is the data power SOA appliances, can act as NSF clients to essentially use NSF as a way to get to RACF. So it can use RACF for its authorization and access controls. Again, using NSF as the gateway into it there. We're also looking at building more capabilities in this area in the future. And like I said, we look at NSF as sort of a vehicle for extending security services out farther into the enterprise. So again, like Arnie said, kind of watch this space. We're looking to build on this as well. Last slide here is just kind of showing you sort of the progression of security capabilities in ComServer over the last few releases. There's certainly been a lot of emphasis here, and it's not changing anytime soon that I can see. We definitely have more work on the horizon from things like, you know, IPv6, different security things there, new different kinds of encryption technologies and things like that. So, you know, it's an active area, and it's the place we're going to continue to build. So we're kind of excited about what we're doing here and hoping that we're delivering the functions to customers that they're needing. So any feedback on that would be welcome. And then last slide here is for more information. There's a bunch of references here, some books, presentations, that kind of thing. So any other questions before we close?
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.